Hi, it's Tom here. We've got a great end of year episode of Last Orders for you today with the brilliant Simon Evans joining us to reflect on this mad year. I should say we recorded it last week just before the Tier 4 lockdown and the blockades, but much of the discussion of lockdown and where we might be headed next is pretty depressingly prescient. Before we get into the episode, though, I just want to say thank you to everyone who has listened to and rated and reviewed and shared the show this year. And a special thank you to those of you who have donated to Spiked, either monthly or whenever you can. All of Spiked's content, as you'll know, is free, and it always will be. It's because of your generosity that we can keep producing shows like Last Orders, as well as our other podcasts and our daily articles and essays. So thanks to those who have donated. And if you haven't, but you'd like to, why not make a donation to Spiked this Christmas? Just go to spiked-online.com and click the big red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the big red donate button. Thanks so much. Enjoy the episode. See you next year. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is the show all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship, though for the foreseeable future, it will mainly be about lockdown. In this episode, we take a look back on 2020, a year that will go down in history for all the wrong reasons. Hello and welcome to this special end of year edition of Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, and to discuss a year that will go down in history, I think, for all of the wrong reasons, I'm joined as I am every episode by the IEA's Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Tom, and a happy Christmas to you.
Feeling very festive over here. So, and we're delighted to be welcoming back for this extra special episode one of Britain's finest comedians and a return guest, as I say, Simon Evans. Simon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Very kind of you to invite me. Thank you.
So there's so much to talk about: COVID, lockdown, that kind of woke cultural revolution we had in the middle of the year as well. But before we do all that, Simon, I wanted to ask you about what it's been like being a comedian over the course of the past 12 months. I mean, presumably performing's been more or less illegal for most of this time. People are having to adapt. How have you and your fellow comics been dealing with the new normal?
I think it's been quite humbling, and possibly for those of us that survive it, possibly not without its benefits psychologically. I think it has been a learning experience. And what I've learned in a nutshell is that, important as the comedian is, the audience is probably the crucial part of an enjoyable comedy night out, because we are still able, of course, to perform on Zoom and various other platforms, but the absence of a collection of people around you laughing turns out to be such a crucial missing ingredient. I don't know that we had, all of us, ever quite absorbed that fact previously, and there is a tendency, of course, to center yourself in whatever activity it is you're performing, especially when you're well paid for it. So that's been interesting. Some comedians have probably risen to the challenge of operating in a digital format for the time being better than others. But I think most of us have realized the limitations of what we do and are perhaps going to be that much more grateful and respectful of those who provide forums and so on for us to do it in the new year, those of them that have survived. It was quite interesting early on in the year, even in March, when, as soon as my tour was sort of terminated and I sort of came to a shuddering halt, immediately my WhatsApp groups, some of which were sort of set up in order to survive the crisis and some of which I'd already had ticking over, were just full of hilarious memes and GIFs and graphs and chalkboards outside of pubs and repurposed pictures of Meghan and Harry and God knows all the rest of it. And none of them came from professional comedians. They were all just emerging naturally, you know, bubbling up out of the swamp of humanity. And that was quite humbling in itself as well. I realized that very few comedians have anything that's an improvement on, you know, the natural wit of the great British people. It's just that we obviously, you know, have the advantage of a microphone and some lights to sort of bring the focus in. But yeah, so in that respect, it's been quite interesting. But I say all of that as somebody who is very lucky to have had a professional wife who has continued to work, in fact, worked harder than ever from home in the public relations game in the last sort of 9 months. She's taken on as much work as she can possibly handle and then some. And so, you know, we've been able to feed the kids. I might not necessarily have been quite so philosophical about that whole experience if that hadn't been the case.
A professional wife sounds like you pay her. It sounds like she from Russia.
She agreed to cut her rates for
She's
the year, which is very nice.
Qualified wife. my Dr. Biden.
So let's move on to COVID itself then, Chris, because it's been about a year now, I guess, since the reports first started surfacing out of Wuhan of this new and deadly virus. It's been about 9 months, I think, since Boris Johnson made that announcement to put us all under house arrest, this huge, global, unprecedented experiment in authoritarianism to the ends of trying to stop the spread of this disease. Now, in terms of the UK, there's many different ways you can measure it, but it's hard not to look at our death toll, our economic hit, and think that we've had a good hand in all of this. Where do you think, looking back over the past 12 months/9 months, things went so wrong in the UK's case?
Well, I mean, firstly, it's less than a year since we heard about it. It's certainly a year since it was circulating quite virulently in Wuhan, and the Chinese told us nothing about it, but that's another story. Where did we go wrong? I suppose, I mean, it depends how you look at it, doesn't it? But if you wanted to copy the countries that have objectively done best, then we should have tried to suppress it, shouldn't we, as soon as we heard about it? But that requires an enormous amount of hindsight. Taiwan are very distrustful of the Chinese with good reason, so they basically close their borders with China on the first day that anybody around the world heard of it, the 31st of December. They immediately said, right, we're going to start screening at the border. We did nothing. It's now proven that the virus was in Europe and almost certainly in Britain in December and possibly quite a bit earlier than that. So that policy of suppression would have had to begin very early on. Very few people even now seriously talk about closing the borders in Britain. I'm not sure why that is, if it's just this kind of, you know, obsession some people have with open borders. But you can't even attempt to suppress it without closing your borders. I notice the Isle of Man has now closed its borders and managed to become COVID-free, the only part of the UK that has. So we are an island. You know, it's notable that most of the places that have done very well are islands and have cut off travel quite early, and they've also worn masks and done various other things. I don't know how much that has an effect. But certainly, if you want to suppress it, then you have to act early. And I just don't think there was any chance of us suppressing it. Once the government changed its policy from a more or less herd immunity strategy to a, well, God knows, how would you even describe it? Sort of a semi-suppression approach, I suppose. Try and bring it down and then let people out and then play whack-a-mole every now and again. I don't know. I think, with hindsight, I think you can say we maybe should have closed the borders at the same time Taiwan did, and got a contact tracing system that could smack out the odd cases of the merged. But in practice, we couldn't have done that. We wouldn't have done that. We didn't have the knowledge. And by the time we did try and suppress it, there were way too many people with the virus for us to ever reasonably suppress it without a Wuhan-style lockdown, which I don't think people would. Well, I was going to say, I don't think people would put up with. People put up with a hell of a lot, and a lot of people want to cancel Christmas. So maybe I'm overestimating the lust for liberty amongst the British people.
That definitely seems to have been overestimated this year. But Simon, what's your take on all of this? I think from previous interviews I've seen you a rare advocate of the take it on the chin strategy, which was famously enunciated by Boris Johnson to Holly Willoughby, etc., on our morning TV screens. But
I look back to that interview as a rare moment, the briefest example of enlightened government. I don't know. I mean, it is possible, obviously, even with Sweden being the most obvious example of a country which has essentially just relied on common sense and mutual trust and so on to socially distance sufficiently, but to allow it to gradually move through society. But obviously, I mean, if ever there was a case with lies, damn lies and statistics, it is so easy to present the case you want to by picking out the statistics you want to, and also to overturn that case. And if you wanted to support Sweden's model, you know, there is plenty of evidence there to suggest that it was quite a sensible approach. And if you want to prove why we could never have done that, even if we'd wanted to, plenty of evidence, you know, plenty of differences that emerge in terms of population density and just the culture of the place as well. I think the thing about Britain is it's a big, very heterogeneous place now. There are, you know, a lot of different towns and cities and rural areas, and there are a lot of differences between Newcastle and Devon and London and even South London and North London. And there are a lot of differences between different ethnicities and different age groups. And it's very, very hard to find a protocol which would have satisfied all of those. And I do feel a certain amount of sympathy for the government when it was confronted with this situation early on. As you say, you know, obviously in hindsight, the thing to do would have been the Taiwan, Singapore, Korea approach and so on, or even you could say New Zealand. all of those places feel very much more homogenous to me than I think Britain is at the moment, and they were far more likely to fall into step. And they have that, you know, people have written, I think that guy wrote that book, 10% Less Democracy, was largely focused on Singapore and the degree to which a different bargain has been struck there. They have accepted that there is to be some degree of authoritarianism in order to keep their economy and their lifestyles humming along in a relatively frictionless manner. And that's never been the British way. You know, we don't have that attitude. We have paid for it, I think, in the long run. Now, of course, we are experiencing arguably more authoritarian control and for longer than would have necessarily been necessary had we, you know, taken it on the chin early on. But as Chris says, I mean, one way or the other, as you hinted, I think most people feel we have had the worst of both worlds. We have absolutely cratered the economy, and we have also seen our old people in particular just dying in droves. And it does kind of feel like, you know, that there is very, it's very hard to say, well, at least we did X, you know, at least we saved Y. I mean, there really is very little upside to what we've seen. And it's exposed apart from anything else, although I was sympathetic with it to some extent. You know, Johnson's determination to get Brexit through meant that he recreated the cabinet with that sole aim in mind, and the degree to which that made it vulnerable, you know, under different circumstances and for different purposes has been horribly exposed. I think that is, I think most people would have to acknowledge that has happened, even however sympathetic you were to the prioritisation of Brexit in November.
Chris, I just wanted to ask you briefly about the role of public health and the public health establishment. And obviously this is your area of expertise, and you've written for many years about the amount of time that the public health establishment seemed to bother about lifestyle issues. This was the moment in which what we all assumed would be their shining hour, the moment that they would actually step up and, you know, do what we assume these institutions are set up to do. And yet, if you look at the World Health Organization, Public Health England, you've written about this extensively, they were either kind of hapless or actively a problem in the midst of dealing with this pandemic. Could you just, I mean, we're at the point now where PHE is either disbanded or on the verge of being disbanded in the UK. So how did we get to this point? Why were the public health establishment so, at best, useless in the midst of this?
Because they are useless, because they're incompetent. I mean, that's as simple as that. They're incompetent. I've been saying it for years, and people haven't really paid any attention, because who cares really what the WHO say or Public Health England say? Who cares if epidemiological models are made up? Well, this year, people have had to care. They've had to care whether there's actually any evidence behind these curves and the models that make such a profound difference to our lives. They care about whether Public Health England can actually use a spreadsheet. You know, normally it's not that important whether they can use a spreadsheet, but on this occasion it turned out incredibly important. I'm referring to the incident a couple of months ago when they massively underestimated how many cases there were. I've already lost count of all the things that PHE and WHO got wrong. I've written a paper about it called You Had One Job, if people want to catch up. But I do know that when that came out, which was about July, it was followed by a number of other things which really should have been added in, all of which were equally bizarre. I think the WHO has only this month kind of accepted that COVID is airborne. You know, it was quite an important thing to know, that, you know, pretty crucial, much more important to be aware of that than to be washing your hands and singing happy birthday. So these people are really incompetent. I think if you listen back to the podcast from this year, I seem to recall me and the other guests were generally quite positive about the epidemiologists early on. We thought, well, these aren't the same as the nanny statists we're used to dealing with, who are just a bunch of jumped up sociologists and what have you. These are real, you know, virologists. They know their stuff. And of course, we found out quite quickly that they didn't know their stuff at all. And you've got people like John Edmonds, the guy who sort of looks like a very deflated Simon Pegg, sounds like him too, still going on TV, pushing for lockdowns at every possible opportunity. When he's there, you can go online and see videos of him saying the exact opposite. Explicitly calling for a herd immunity strategy.
He's on like a mea culpa tour almost at this point, like he feels the need to repent for that original position.
Yeah, they sort of remind me of the deposed ancient regime, you know, walking around the palaces, but in the revolutionary uniform, hoping nobody recognizes them, you know? So yeah, these people are incompetent. It's disappointing to find out that even the people who actually deal with epidemic diseases are as incompetent as the ones who try and deal with vaping and drinking and obesity. But unfortunately, they are.
Simon, you touched for a second there on the question of liberty and our freedoms. And it's hard to overstate how full and the extent of which our liberties have been constricted this year, you know, and it kind of has come from all sides. We've obviously had government basically ruling by decree putting us under house arrest, laws being made with very little parliamentary oversight, protests being suspended for a large part of the year, which is something that the left strangely said nothing about because it was only really Piers Corbyn who was getting caught up in the net of that. Even outside of government, you know, the kind of censorship that we've seen from big tech, Google and Facebook taking the role on, it seems like harried into it by the media and government and whatever to try and limit discussion. And I guess just on that question, there's now that we're the vaccine's here, now that it's being rolled out, there's a lot of talk about how quickly we'll get back to normal. But how quickly can we kind of snap back out of that? How quickly can we kind of retrieve those freedoms, but also have the kind of self-confidence to exercise them after a year of just being bombarded by these messages to stay away from each other and to avoid public space? Like, do you see this as something which people are going to want to get to normal quite quickly? It will take a long time to unpick those kinds of restrictions that we've had put on top of us this year?
That's a huge question, and it has a number of elements to it. I think psychologically, I think it will take time to unpick and retrieve our normality. And I think people will respond partly to changing circumstances, such as the availability of the vaccine, but they will also just pick up on what everybody else is doing. We are a mimetic species, basically. We change and we adapt according to what we see around us. Very few people, you know, lead in this situation. And so I don't know that we've ever really, as a society, ever had to understand what it might take in order to reassert our independence and freedom. Because one of the great fears that a lot of people were expressing, even back in February and March, is that once authoritarian measures are ramped up, you know, they tend to be sticky. They ratchet. They don't come down easily. People were saying this, of course, 20 years ago after 9/11, the surveillance that was increased then and the intrusion into people's private lives. And of course, a lot of people felt that was completely justified, depending, of course, on whether you were likely to be profiled by that kind of intrusion. And to be honest, in a slightly different vein as well, I know a lot of people in the last 2 or 3 years, in particular since Boris Johnson won leadership of the Tory party, were expressing a lot of concern about the sort of cavalier attitude he had towards conventions that were observed in Parliament and in Cabinet and so on in order to get through certain votes. And I, as somebody who was quite keen just to see Brexit get done, you know, to adopt his slightly childish but useful abbreviation of the complexities, kind of wave that through a little bit. But I can't help wondering now whether that wasn't to some extent a dry run, not intentional dry run, of course, but, you know, to some extent a dry run for the cavalier approach the government now has to our timeless freedoms and liberties. So I think it's going to be very difficult. The Silicon Valley thing is a different thing again, and that is, I think, even more worrying, partly because it's like global, but also because I think that's where real power rests at the moment. You know, I think it's very much easier for us to throw Johnson's government out if we do, and, you know, it wouldn't be unthinkable by any means just because he's got us through a pandemic. You know, the people threw Winston Churchill out after World War II. They'll certainly be quite happy enough to throw out Boris Johnson. He will at least at last have managed to ape and mirror his great hero. But it's very much harder to get rid of Google if you decide that they're being intrusive. I mean, anyone who's even tried to find an alternative platform to Twitter or something because they think it's overstepping the right it has to censor and monitor and edit material realizes it's virtually impossible. This is where, you know, real power rests. And it's quite interesting as a comedian that you're constantly told and confronted with, you know, one of the things you may want to talk about later is this kind of, I think, to some extent, rather spurious or specious, I can never remember which one's which, right-wing, left-wing divide between comedians. We never see any right-wing ones, but a lot of people will parrot the line that, well, it's because punching up is great, addressing your satire and your wrath and your barbs towards the powerful, but punching down is just cruel and nasty and mean and bullying. But nobody ever seems to notice that where the power really has, you know, moved on. And yes, of course, you should, you know, tell jokes that ridicule Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock, and they have a degree of power and status, but very much harder to tell jokes that ridicule our dependency on Google and Facebook and Twitter. But that actually is where real power is now residing. And that's where, you know, if you want to be a modern day George Carlin, that's where your focus could be, I suspect. Very much harder to personify. I mean, that's part of the genius. We have Mark Zuckerberg just about for Facebook. But I mean, is there a single individual that people recognize by name when they think about Google? I don't think there is there?
No, certainly not. And he certainly doesn't have that kind of profile, which makes it very difficult to rail against, as you say, which is strange. I mean, Chris, on this topic of, we've, you know, lamented the fact that if you believe the opinion polls, at least, lockdown has had a lot of popular support. It's quite clear that the government have got very used to, quite quickly, ruling by decree. Is there a danger here that this kind of authoritarianism has been kind of normalized to some extent? This will be the approach to future pandemics, or it just becomes the approach to other issues. You've already got some Greens talking about a lockdown for the environment. Yeah. Things are similar. Is that the danger here, that this has become a exercise that has legitimized these kinds of authoritarian policies?
I'm afraid so, yeah. I think it was only last week the BBC and various other outlets were reporting the record declining carbon emissions this year, as if it was a wonderful thing. Air pollution too. And obviously these are good things, but yeah, it all comes down to the trade-off, doesn't it?
All it took was mass death and crashing of the economy.
The total end of civilization for a good year or so. Tamandra Harkness wrote a very good article in Unheard called "It's Not Our Job to Protect the NHS." And she points out quite rightly that, you know, a winter crisis is not just a 2020-21 thing. We have a winter crisis literally every year. And other countries don't, by the way. But we do with the NHS. And it's not at all uncommon for the NHS to be putting people out in the corridor on trolleys and so on. And she asked the question that, you know, having made all the sacrifices we made this year, essentially for that reason, the one, you know, spoken objective was to give everybody who gets COVID a chance to, you know, get in a hospital bed and get the best possible treatment. Having done that, are we going to start closing the theatres and the cinemas every January when the NHS gets overwhelmed just with flu, which it does and it will? I think it's a reasonable question to ask, particularly when we've had a year in which people have been so used, as you say, to sacrificing their liberty, but also so used to clapping the bloody NHS and basing everything around it. And it is a new thing, the idea that we protect the NHS rather than vice versa. So I think that's worrying. I also think that the fact that this is going to go on well into next year is going to really soften people up. Eventually you just get almost institutionalized, you know, like prisoners do, you know, and solitary confinement is used as a way to break people, let's face it. And there's a lot of people who've been more or less in solitary confinement. And by the time it's over, they'll have been in it for well over a year, which is generally considered to be kind of an all it takes to break the human spirit. So yeah, we have got used to all sorts of things we shouldn't have got used to this year. And it's very worrying.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So just to move on to some of the other developments this year that have been very, very significant. So I want to come to Black Lives Matter and the huge impact, the global impact that that movement and that moment, the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, seems to have had. And what seemed to be so strange about it was, the first of all, it was global. This was something which became a localized injustice, which soon went around the world, but also how it suddenly became about so much else. We quickly went from talking about police brutality to toppling statues to memory holding sitcoms. It just very quickly became about culture, hence the kind of tag that we've been using to refer to it, this woke cultural revolution. Simon, watching all of that unfurl, how did that happen? How did this kind of new kind of woke cultural orthodoxy cement itself so quickly in that moment?
Well, I've been watching worrying events, mainly from the States, for about 3 or 4 years on Twitter. I suppose I first woke up to it with the Evergreen College riots, where Brett Weinstein was sort of threatened with baseball bats for challenging a particular day of action that was proposed on campus. And so it didn't come out of nowhere for me. And I think maybe a few of us who waste too much time on Twitter were a little bit more aware of it than others. But it's very interesting to see how, I mean, this is one of the things, how can I phrase this? This is one of the things I think is really interesting about the last 12 months, is the extent to which some organizations and some tendencies or mindsets, I suppose you might say, I don't want to get deep into conspiracy theory versions of it, seemed more primed to take advantage of the opportunities that lockdown and everything else was presenting than others did. And they absolutely grabbed it with both hands. I'm not saying there wasn't something particularly visceral and unusually upsetting about watching George Floyd being, you know, whether he was being choked to death or compressed to death or however you want to put it, but anyway, being knelt on as he died. That was a pretty brutal experience, anyone who wanted to watch it. But there is a sense that that sort of thing does happen several times a year, probably, in the United States, some sort of unseemly police execution or whatever. It's not an entirely once-in-a-decade event. it obviously met the perfect storm, really, of a bunch of young people who've been cooped up indoors and desperately needed some kind of focused target for their anger and their ire and their frustration, that something that they could gather around. A virus clearly wasn't sort of providing them with that. And obviously, again, after 3.5 years of a Trump administration, which, you know, they had convinced themselves was the dawn of a new fascism, this all kind of kicked off. It was all just the perfect storm. And I wasn't entirely surprised about it in America. I was a little bit surprised, though, the success it had in, you know, crossing the Atlantic and informing the behavior in Whitehall and the desecration of Churchill and the cenotaph and so on. And I'll be honest, I didn't much like that. Whatever else we have and whatever other problems we have, the police killing unarmed black men in this country is not a widespread issue. It simply isn't on the same scale. We just don't have those same race relations problems. We have our own problems, which we need to deal with, no doubt, and which perhaps should be protested. But we don't have the record of police discharging their firearms or whatever without having first made sure that there was no quicker way to bring the thing to a more peaceful resolution. It just isn't an issue here. And I do think there's been an alarming tendency in this country for some time now to try and import the problems of America, because they just seem to be a lot more exciting and glamorous and A-list than ours do. You know, ours are rather grubbier and more intractable, and to do with poverty, and you could say it's inequality or whatever, but certainly people living sort of miserable lives rather than naked police brutality and so on.
Chris, another striking thing this year has just been the embrace of this movement by what we would call woke capital. All of these huge companies, whether they were tech companies, all sorts of firms were just lining up to pledge their allegiance to this in a way that I don't think we've really seen before. You know, we had every institution, it felt like the Premier League, you know, had to display BLM on the back of their shirts, etc. What do you make of that, the fact that so many of these institutions, which previously probably would want to stay out of politics because of the old Michael Jordan dictum, even Republicans buy sneakers, you know, you need to stay out of this, they all piled into it. What do you think explains that, the embrace of all of that?
Well, it suggests that kind of ideology is in the ascendancy and is dominant. You know, I'm assuming these companies realize who their market is. And I know that they have been known to make mistakes in the past. And the Gillette thing didn't go down very well, and there had to be a bit of U-turn. There's been a bit of a backlash against the Premier League, and rightly so. I don't think they should ever have got involved with that. But of course, as soon as the fans were allowed back in places like Millwall and Colchester, as many of us predicted, it was very quickly dissolved. But I think it shows that, you know, this is the dominant ideology. When big business is behind things, it's a bit like what you're saying before about Facebook and Google. You know, you can't make jokes about them. Find out who you're not allowed to criticize. You know who the dominant people are and the hegemony, as I'd say, by, you know, who's backing them and what you're not allowed to criticize. And it's a very censorious movement. And that's the thing that really worries me about it. What do you do when people no longer kind of even accept the same type of rules? That's what worries me about it. I'm not talking about picking very specific form of classical liberalism that I'd like to introduce. I just mean the basic rules in academia, especially, that you can discuss anything. For example, once you have people going like, no, that is wrong, that is in itself an evil system or a racist system or what have you, how can you move forward? How can you move forward with people who want to rip down history, literally in the case of statues? I mean, I, like most people, couldn't really care less about most statues, don't know who most of them are. But there's this sort of iconoclasm, this desire to rewrite or obliterate parts of history, and then to shout people down and to not allow discussion. And that is the worrying part of it for me, this general censoriousness that you see across the piece.
I think to some extent the big corporations are behind this because it distracts attention and focus from the economic issues and their own sort of business practices and so on, and repositions it as structural racism and so on in society, which needs addressing, and feminism and LGBT rights and putting a rainbow flag on the tailplane of your Boeing 777 is a much, much easier project to get behind than addressing your ability to offshore your entire profit for the last year and pay $5 halfpenny in taxes, or the fact that your board, despite your vocal support for intersectional feminism, your board still seems to consist entirely of white and or East Asian gentlemen of a certain age in immaculate Savile Row tailoring. you know, or the Google equivalent of that, who will Google, who will sack James Damore for writing a memo in which he explores the possibility that men are more temperamentally suited to software engineering, which, to be honest, is nothing to be proud of, in my view. You know, as half the species, but, you know, he will get sacked for that memo. This was a couple of years ago, of course. But if you look at Google's board, it still very much represents that. Well, if Google feel that really isn't the case, then it's within their gift, surely, if any company can do so, to elevate some women and people of colour onto that level of managerial responsibility. But they don't seem to do it. They just seem to sack people who come up with theories about it. This is the game that is played at the senior level within industry. And, you know, it's happened for years. I remember being almost sick in my mouth when I went to play a gig in a pub in Camden a few years ago that was part of the Camden Comedy Festival, and the exterior of it had been covered with various types of Converse basketball shoes in various sort of camouflage or, you know, different colours, and some of them were based on famous artists and so on. And they were all very colourful and wonderful, and they were supporting this kind of alt comedy, you know, this kind of independent. Well, Converse is owned by Nike. It's one of the largest corporations in the world. If that's how people want to wear their shoes, you know, but it's not remotely counterculture. Converse couldn't be less counterculture. It might have been once in the 60s. I don't know when it started. Maybe once upon a time it was a legitimate, you know, badge of honor, or it was a sense that you were an outsider. But now you are quite seriously and literally more counterculture if you wear handmade brogues from Northampton than you are if you buy Converse shoes made by children in Vietnam. No, it's just these things are such, there's such a cloud of smoke put up by these corporations to confuse you about where the real power. And, you know, as I say, it's hard to make it funny in a way. This is why a lot of comedians don't sort of go in there, because it's much, much easier to get laughs just out of, you know, pointing out what a bumbling buffoon Boris Johnson is. Everyone can see that immediately. It's a big cartoonish image. The murky denizens of international finance and corporation marketing and so on, very much harder to get your teeth into.
It's a good point about the corporations tapping onto these things, but they've always done it. I remember when Nike was controversial, God, about 30 years ago, they used the song Revolution by the Beatles in an advert. I think it was the first time the Beatles had ever been used in an advert, but the fact that it was Nike in particular, this is probably at the height of the Naomi Klein kind of anti-Nike spirit, made it very controversial. But they were trying to be cool. The corporation's always trying to be cool, so I guess they're tapping onto a lot of this because it is considered to be, you know, fashionable with younger people who are the target market. And I don't really object to that as much. I mean, Simon's quite right that the whole thing's fairly ridiculous and transparently silly. But the other point he makes is absolutely bang on, which is that this is a way of avoiding talking about class. That you can have, and it goes right the way up from Eaton up to Goldman Sachs. You've got massive disparities in class in your border, and that's a real disparity, and indeed in your office. And if you get in some various token minority groups into the boardroom, onto the photos, that avoids you having to talk about that. And that has been going on the left for a very long time, ever since they got sick of the working class, basically in the 80s. And that absolutely has permeated through to the whole woke culture.
Completely agree with that. I mean, Simon, you touched there on the comedy industry. And we've seen actually over the course of the past week when we're recording this, another spasm of this debate about right-wing comedians is kind of how it's framed. But broadly speaking, the perceived need for more political diversity in comedy, particularly the BBC's new director general saying, or at least hinting that he wanted to go more in this direction, that the output was too left-wing, too woke. This is a conversation that you yourself have found yourself in the middle of, because you're often named, perhaps incorrectly, you can let us know, as like one of two right-wing comedians, quote-unquote, who get these spots. So just give us a sense of, you know, what's your perspective on that particular debate? Because it is something that isn't going away, seemingly. There does seem to be a need to respond to this sense that comedy is too much down the line with this woke politics.
In terms of being a right-wing comedian myself, my point usually is that I just have a broader range of targets. I just think, you know, there should be a wider range of people who are subject to scorn on Mock the Week or whatever. And certainly, the big issue, obviously, for this was Brexit. And this was what tore it apart. You know, this was what cleft society in two, obviously. And it found 99% of the comedians all on one side. And it didn't seem to me to be the side of the common man versus the establishment. The comedians seem to be on the side of the establishment, although, of course, that is in itself a highly contentious view. Many people say, oh, you know, I hard to think Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, complaining about the elites or whatever. So obviously it's, you know, it's nuanced, and you can argue the toss back and forth. But certainly the government, as it was under David Cameron, wanted us to remain in Europe, and like the great unwashed basically wanted us to get out. That was the big divide. And the comedians all came down on the side of the government and the experts and the economists and the acronyms. And so that seemed a bit odd at that time. But I think comedy would be improved on its own terms just by having a little bit more diversity of thought. And as I say, it's not a question. I mean, there was a ridiculous tweet which Catherine Ryan put out a couple of days ago saying basically, as a comedian, if you're such a genius that you can get laughs by complimenting and liking Matt Hancock, then, you know, fair play to you. Well, of course, that isn't what he is asking for. You're not asking for comedians to go on and defend the government. You simply say that equally ripe for satire has surely to be academia, you know, woke capital, yes, Len McCluskey. I mean, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn's tenure at the head of the Labour Party, but also the Lib Dems. I would certainly have said, God, in any sort of enlightened world, Joe Biden seems extraordinarily ripe for ridicule. I mean, it's an absolute absurdity, and it's openly discussed. You know, I mean, that you can currently get 1,000 to 1 on Kamala Harris being the next president, which is, I think, extraordinarily generous odds. I've got 20 quid on that because, you know, he is literally teetering on the edge of senility. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of clips of him losing his way and just grinding to a halt, making speeches of one kind or another and forgetting famous lines from the American independent documents and so on. He's a farcical figure, and I've not seen a single British comedian, you know, come out and say a single thing against him, because to do so would apparently seem to, you know, support the idea that Donald Trump should get a second term. There's a huge amount of the cake that's just not being eaten, basically. It's focusing on a single slice the whole time. And the whole 360 degrees of public life should be up for grabs. It should all be attacked with venom and enthusiasm. And if any one individual isn't capable of attacking the whole thing, surely on a panel game with 6 guests and a host, you would be able to find room for a couple of them that found, you know, Biden and Harris, you know, as laughable a proposition, and certainly, you know, American politics generally, rather than simply the state of Donald Trump's ass, you know.
Very true. Chris, we're fast running out of time, but I did want to try to squeeze in. Seems strange to say to squeeze in, because we used to talk about it all the time. But nanny state issues. I feel like we've been quite preoccupied with something closer to talk police state issues for the most part this year. But there's been so much that you've been writing about, which is kind of either the usual kind of nanny state stuff just going on under the surface, or even kind of the cover of coronavirus being a new impetus for a lot of these policies. So what have been the kind of standout things this year, you think, in that kind of realm in relation to lifestyle, which we used to talk about so much on this podcast?
Yes, well, one day we will again. I wish we will meet again. Well, a number of countries banning the sale of tobacco and alcohol completely. That's going to be quite big, yeah. High up there. The South African Supreme Court actually just recently said that it was unconstitutional to ban cigarettes, so that won't be happening when they have lockdown 3 or 4 or whichever one they're on at the moment. In the UK, this attack on food. It's funny how food's been so central to this, isn't it? Like, the government seems determined to make people eat food, whether it's subsidising it in August or forcing you to order it if you want a drink now in the diminishing number of tier 2 areas. And at the same time, attacking it by banning the advertising of it and all the other stuff that was in the so-called childhood obesity strategy, or maybe just obesity. I think they've dropped the pretenses about children now. So that was an odd thing. Obviously, as you kind of alluded to, nanny state stuff all seems pretty trivial compared to the police state stuff. But it has been quite interesting how many of these little pet projects politicians have still been pushing on with, even when you'd think it would be all hands to the pump trying to deal with COVID and pushing out the vaccine and all this kind of stuff. You still get numerous announcements about climate change from Boris Johnson. We're going to rip out everyone's gas boilers, and we're going to ban the advertising of popcorn and this and that. You know, so many of these, you can just see them yearning to go back to the good old days of worrying about fairly trivial issues where they feel they have some kind of control, setting targets for 30 years hence, because it doesn't make any difference to them personally. That's what they'd like to be doing. You know, these sort of pygmies in the parliament want to get back to talking about carbon dioxide and junk food and binge drinking, because it's just so much easier, so much more comfortable than having to deal with a real crisis, which, as you said when we began, they have failed on every front of. It's not just that they failed, is it? It's that they do things like eat out to help out. And Grant Shapps this week was talking about he's cutting tickets on coaches so people can get home for Christmas. What are they doing? He's got these COVID coaches, death coaches, the COVID death bus, cutting fares on railways and coaches so people can get together rather than going in a car with one or two other people fairly securely. They can get on with a bunch of strangers for 6 hours and drive off to wherever they're going. I mean, it's not just that they haven't, you know, done well. It's just that they seem to have picked ways of doing things remarkably badly.
So just to close this out, I'm not asking anyone to make predictions, but as it's a end of year podcast, I also want to look a little bit towards the future. There's been huge developments in the last few weeks, obviously with the vaccine, etc. I just want to kind of get a sense from you each of how hopeful you are, I guess, for the new year. Are things going to get back to normal, or is this going to be something which is going to drag on and on? So Simon, you first. What do you think 2021 is going to look like?
Well, you know, hostage to fortune, my gigs, which I was supposed to do in March, have been pushed back to the autumn and then pushed back to the spring, and now some of them are being pushed back from the spring. But to be honest, I think part of the issue is there's going to have to be a point at which theatres and live venues, from my point of view, have to decide whether or not they are willing to work hard to find a compromise solution. Funnily enough, and I don't want to sound like callous about it, but to some extent, the degree to which the government have offered them support has been counterproductive, because if they feel they can just sit there and close and furlough the staff and take grants or subsidies or whatever and subsist on that, then they are not going to come up with solutions. Whereas in reality, I think we need to now start looking at, you know, I've said to many of my venues, I will do 2 shows in a night. That means you can get in a third of your audience in the first one and a third of your audience in the second one. You get a 2/3 of a house. That's obviously worth opening for. That's not an unusual situation anyway for a comedy show. And I'm hopeful that that kind of attitude will start to prevail and we will start to see live shows. But I've got to be honest, you know, in terms of what Chris was saying earlier about, you know, the new normal and being institutionalized, I'm already starting to feel like I don't know if I want to go back to work. I've enjoyed not driving up the M6 on a rainy Thursday afternoon, you know. I'm kind of becoming, this is early retirement. This is the same age. I am the age now at which my father took early retirement, being made redundant in his mid-50s. He discovered a new lease of life. He celebrated his 90th birthday under lockdown this year. And I'm not sure he would have done that if he'd had to work till he was 65. But in all seriousness, I think for me, the big issue is the young. You know, I have a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. I want them to get out and start enjoying life again in the spring. I don't think it's been psychologically good for them at all. And I think in particular, anyone between the age of 16 and 30 has got to be allowed to make their own choices and encouraged to get back out and do it. The virus presents no threat to them. I don't want to be cruel about the elderly, but they've had their shot. And I think it's about time they took care of themselves and let the young inherit the earth again.
And Chris, what about you? How do you see 2021 panning out?
Very badly indeed. I've been gloomy about this from day one, almost from day one. And I've been pretty much right. In fact, I've been shown to be too optimistic most of the time. 2021 will be a really hellish year. I think the first 6 months of it will be in lockdown for the majority of the time. I think we'll be in lockdown almost immediately after Christmas. Wales have already said they're going to bring a lockdown in, which from an epidemiological point of view is actually fairly sensible. It also addresses the issue of New Year's Eve, which nobody seems to be wanting to talk about, but presumably there will be lots of parties New Year's Eve. So I think we'll have a lockdown in January. That will go on until February, probably. It may well go on longer. They might call it a tier 4 or whatever the latest euphemism is for lockdown, but I think they will have a lockdown. Because if they don't, they're gonna find that they'll get herd immunity from the virus quicker than they get it from the vaccine. You know, at the moment, about 40,000 people a day are getting COVID and only about 20,000 are getting the vaccine. So this is a race that's not going to be won by science. I accept probably vaccination rates will go up quite a bit, to be fair. But it's going to be a long wait for people to be vaccinated. There's no obvious target, you know, for bringing things back to normal. Seems to me that once you've vaccinated everyone over the age of 80, you're more than halving the number of people who die from COVID. And presumably at that point, you can't really claim that the NHS is under any severe threat of being overwhelmed. I don't know how many people there are over 80 in this country, but presumably not all that many. So I would have thought it's doable to get them all vaccinated in the next 6 weeks or so, perhaps. Mm. We have a competent government, big if. Don't get Public Health England involved. Just get the army to do it or something. But yeah, it's going to be a slog. The economy's knackered. We had 900,000 redundancies recently, and this is why we've still got a furlough in place. There's no obvious reason to make anyone redundant, actually, if you've got the furlough going, but it's already happening. So I think the sky's the limit for unemployment. If you want a optimistic note, then you can say a lot of people have got quite a bit of money. There's bound to be a big bounce back in a lot of industries. People presumably will be going on lots of holidays and going out drinking, eating more meals than they ordinarily would do. So you can expect a bounce back, but there will be so many businesses just gone, particularly in the hospitality industry. Those premises will still be there. Somebody will buy them up. It'd probably be a Chinese consortium, knowing our luck, will buy up half the British pub estate and turn them into Yates's wine lodges or something. But yeah, those premises eventually will get back on their feet. But I don't see us getting back to kind of February levels of GDP for about 4 years, really. And I think there'll be a long period of really bad unemployment, bankruptcies and redundancies and misery in the meantime. So I think in many ways, 2021 will be even worse than this one. Happy
Merry
Christmas.
Yes. And Simon, you said you know a lot of your dates are put on hold, but is there anything you want to plug, or is there any dates that haven't been moved or put on permanent hold, or where can people find you?
The Simon Evans is my website. If you want to visit that, you can see what the tour is called, Work of the Devil. If I do keep getting it moved, then I might take it out to Barbados or somewhere and just perform there.
Isle of Man, maybe? Taiwan? Isle of Man, Hong Kong and South Korea.
There's plenty of opportunities on the Pacific Rim now. But yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, I have to say there's a lot of, it sounds very plausible, Chris's scenario. I suppose forewarned is forearmed, but it's an odd game, comedy. And sometimes, you know, we rise and fall with the fortunes of the nation. Sometimes we seem to go against them. In 2009, which I suppose was the last big sort of recession, when the financial crash, when the aftershock of that really hit the economy, I was braced for a really bad year, and I probably had the best year of my career until that point, partly because I think I got a lot of work that would normally have gone to Jimmy Carr and that kind of, you know, and expenses to make things like that. And there were a lot of companies who could no longer afford them for their Christmas dinner. And so they came hunting around the basement and they found me. So a shred of hope on that basis. But God knows, it's, you know, I think there is some genuine truth to the ridiculous old cliche that as long as you've got your health. And I suppose in that respect, I feel personally quite lucky. I've remained as healthy under lockdown, probably healthier than I would normally be at this time of year due to all the hand washing and the avoidance of public places. So I suppose live in the moment and enjoy it while it lasts.
I think that's a perfect message to end on, and the most hopeful we can hope for. So Chris, Simon, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.